Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sanghang namassami. So, Saturday night, October 18th, it's Katina season. We had our community work day today. Last Sunday we had our Katina ceremony. And right now, Longpa, Pasano, Ajahn Amaro are at Pacific Hermitage, White Salmon, Washington. And tomorrow they'll have their Papa ceremony, which is like a mini Katina. So in Thailand, Katina season, you might go and listen to all-night Dhamma talks in many different monasteries. Here, we just have a couple monasteries, so, and we haven't yet picked up the all-night Dhamma talk thing, so we just have comparatively small ceremonies here. In the Katina season, we'll go for a month after the end of the Vasa till the full end of the four-month rainy season according to the Pali calendar, the lunar calendar. So it was a work day and a lot of us putting forth effort, virtuous activity, and helping the monastery, cleaning the monastery, and specifically this water project. I wasn't able to join in with the more communal work, which was raking the ditches on the side of the roads to prepare for the rainy season. So myself, Tongkhasapo, and Agarga Doug involved in this water system project, which involves a lot of planning, thinking, preparing. And then it's important to be able to put it down at the end of the day and have that attitude in line with Dhamma. I don't know what's going to happen this evening. Really don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. So we put it down for the evening. So we don't want to be, like there's a saying, you know, smoking by night, flaming by day. So we don't want to be laying down, proliferating about the work we have to do tomorrow, thinking it out, working it out. Sometimes it takes many years of Dhamma practice to figure out that that's not beneficial, that doesn't make it go better. That's a good way to wear oneself out. So we have to be like Ajahn Buddhadasa, where he would say, it's finished. He was building a large Uposatha hall in his monastery, a huge project. Many faceted project. He was personally overseeing many aspects of this project. And somebody asked, when is it going to be finished, this huge project? And he just said, well, it's finished. It's already finished. And they said, what do you mean? It's only halfway done. You have so much to do with this project. It's not even built yet. How can you say it's finished? And he said, well, each day it's just finished. I go through the motions. I do the building and we follow the plan and we do what we can each day and then it's finished at the end of the day. And so his mind is already at a point where he's completely setting things down. So we're going to test ourselves, see if we can do that. It's just dukkha to cling to it and chew it over and proliferate. Also during the meditation, I was listening to this munching outside the window, this fresh grass. These poor starving deer are really feeling the drought, and you see these kind of emaciated deer slinking around the monastery and finally they get some fresh grass to come up. So he's, we have a deer out back gorging itself on fresh grass. It's mudita for the deer. So there's that sense of the seasons changing. Seasons changing. Before long, Vasa is complete. A winter retreat coming along. This is impermanence, anicchang. So something that, there's a couple things that came up in tea time today, is kind of thinking about. One is this idea of the vision quest. We were talking a little bit about Tudong, how it's a tradition in Thailand, and also this Native American idea of the vision quest. And having met someone last year who was a peace pipe carrier and learning a little bit more about this idea of the vision quest and having a vision, walking within a vision. So this is a very good way to view the Dhamma as well, because everything is preceded by intention. And so when we have an intention, that's like having a vision. So say becoming a monk, for example, you've read some sort of teaching, maybe feel inspired, and you at some point give rise to an intention. One has a vision of oneself as a monk. And so this is having a vision, and then one decides to follow through with that intention, and one actually then becomes a monk. And so that's what we call walking within the vision, walking within that vision. So one has a wholesome intention, and then one walks within that vision. So we could think of the monk's life as a vision quest, and we could apply that to the Dhamma in general, practice. One has an intention to come meditate, so that's a vision. One goes into that vision. One actually does it. So anything, any practice you undertake, you have the intention, it's important to have the heart to follow through with it, to just do it. So there's different mental obstructions, greed, desire, aversion, fear, the agati, different biases which keep us from following these wholesome visions. And it's important to be able to ferret out wholesome intentions and then to follow through with them. Dhamma practice doesn't mean just doing nothing or just having no emotions. So there can be that view like, oh, if you practice, you're not supposed to have any emotions. Or like, specifically, if you're a monk or a nun, or you're not supposed to have any emotions. You're supposed to be emotionless and blank. You abide in a state of mental blankness. But that's definitely not the case. Somebody asked Ajahn Mun, there's this story, somebody asked Ajahn Mun once, what is your mind like? And he responded by saying like, well, there's desire, there's aversion, there's fear, there's sadness, there's happiness, there's bliss, there's all these things. And he said, how can you say that? Like, you're this great Kruba Ajahn. And he said, well, I have a heart, so that's why it's that way. So there is the heart, you know, there is the, everybody has their kama, but it's how we relate to it, how we react to these things. So in Thai they say like the arhant, the one who has finished their Dhamma practice, is like pu mai mi pu yu glai jak gilate. So it's like the ones who are far from the defilements. So the defilements are there, but they don't touch them. Or like somebody telling Ajahn Chah, like, you know, I would become a monk, but I would have to be like you. For someone like you, it's easy. You don't have any emotions. And Ajahn Chah said, like, how about you come over a little closer here and I'll I'll hit you. You know? So he's like, you know, how dare you think I don't have any emotions? You know, he's like been through it all in his practice. So really, it's very alive. The practice is very alive. And it's how we investigate the clinging. The clinging is the key. The dissolving the clinging. But this is interesting. We were talking to the first Tuesday of this month. I think it was the 6th. Myself, Venerable Suhajo, Anagarkhajan, heading down to Berkeley Buddhist Monastery, the branch of City of 10,000 Buddhas in Berkeley, near Reverend Hung Shur, one of the leaders in the CTDB community, very good mentor, friend of our community. So, but he's so usually very kind of jovial and personable and doesn't really, you know, he's very humble, so he doesn't talk about his own practice very much. But his mother just passed away, so it's this very rare occasion where he was reflecting on his own practice and revealing some of it for us, which is quite lovely. And we're having coffee in the morning with Reverend Hung Shur, and he's saying how, yeah, this strong clinging to one's parents, there's a thread. Ajahn Mun would say there's this, you know, almost like a etheric umbilical cord which connects you with your mother, specifically with with both your parents, but specifically with the mother. And when your mother dies, then that is severed. So it's even if your practice is very highly developed, still it can be dukkha, it can be very painful. And so he's reflecting on this, and even he was reflecting how Marty, who was Hung Chow, who did the bowing pilgrimage with him, was very filial towards his own mother, and he had said that he felt that his mother was the gateway to the universe. So this profound connection with one's mother. And so Reverend Hung Shur is reflecting on his relationship with his mother and saying how, yeah, this clinging itself actually runs very, very deep, and it is the very gel which brings the six sense bases together at the time of birth. So it's a very powerful force. Yeah, this clinging, it's the very reason we were born. It's what brings us into life. And so to be able to see clinging, he was saying, takes this incredible stillness, hence the cultivation of samadhi, of mental stillness. And he's specifically referring to the jhanas. Actually, Lungpo Cha was more vague about it. Like when he was asked, how much stillness do I need? How much samadhi do I need? He would say, enough to let go. You know, he wouldn't say this or that state. But it's just really nice to hear Reverend Hung Shur saying, like, yeah, you actually need a very, very deep level of stillness to really see clinging. It can't be just thoughts. You can't just think your way to an end of clinging. So it runs very deep. So that kind of leads into the reflection on dependent origination, which also just kind of spoke about briefly at tea time, reflecting on that briefly. Because dependent origination, the first link in that chain taught by the Buddha is ignorance, avijja, which is not knowing, not seeing. And that's specifically not knowing, not seeing the Four Noble Truths, not seeing dukkha, not seeing the cause of dukkha, not seeing the cessation of dukkha, and not seeing a path leading to the cessation of dukkha. That's avijja. And this is just not knowing, not seeing. So as soon as there's knowing and seeing, avijja is gone. It's not like you can see ignorance, but as soon as there's seeing, it's gone. So if seeing is, seeing cannot exist with not seeing. Knowing can't exist with not knowing. And so there is this fundamental ignorance. And this leads into avijja, paccaya, sankhara, sankhara, volitional formations, mental formations, the translation. We could even say thoughts, but it's before that, so it's very early on in the chain. It's sankhara, it's conditioned existence. So we could say not knowing is giving rise to conditions or signs or conditions. And sankhara, paccaya, vijnana, so these conditions are giving rise to consciousness, vijnana, consciousness, that sense of experience. So there is an experience, there is this ability to perceive or be aware. Then there's vijnana, paccaya, nama, rupa, so this consciousness gives rise, conditions, name and form. And this is sometimes thought of as like body and mind, name and form is body and mind, but it's one word, nama rupa. And so the body and mind are connected. It's like one thing. It's not separated. They're not disjoined. As this phrase in the sutta is, conjoined, not disjoined. So they're one thing, the body and mind. And then this gives rise then to salayatana, which is the six sense bases. That's the eye sense base, the ear sense base, nose, tongue, body, and then the mind sense base, which has the ability to think as the sixth sense base. So these are all grouped into one grouping. From nama rupa, you get the salayatana. Six sense bases allow the ability to have contact, which is passa. So salayatana, paccaya, passa, contact. So with that as a condition, contact arises. Contact is specifically based on these six sense bases. So now that there's an eye, there is eye contact with the ear, there is ear contact, and so on. So this contact is very important, because this part of the chain is where friction or different types of experience are starting to happen. It's becoming more diversified in contact, conditioning, feeling, vedana. This is getting more into the realm of like a word that most of us know, vedana, feeling, pleasant feeling, painful feeling, neither pleasant nor painful feeling. And this feeling it leads right onto the next chain, which is tanha, craving, because the default reactions to feeling are different forms of craving and attachment. And this is just completely normal. It's the nature of the mind, and it's how suffering and attachment works. So it's, say, pleasant feeling. The default reaction to pleasant feeling is greed, or wanting to keep, wanting to have it. A default reaction to unpleasant feeling, to pain, is aversion. Don't want it, get rid of it, push it away. And then the default reaction to neither pleasant nor painful feeling, which is a neutral feeling, is delusion. You know, there's nothing much happening. We want something else, something. This is just boring. This is neutral feeling. This isn't interesting. So the delusion, kind of searching, seeking something else. So that's feeling. That's why feeling leads directly into tanha, into craving. Kama tanha, bhava tanha, vibhava tanha. That's sense desire, which is the one that probably most of us know the best. So we live in a realm of desire. The human realm is a desire realm. So sense desire, kama tanha. And then bhava tanha is the desire to become, the desire to be something else, the desire to, the craving for different modes of existence, the craving for different ways of being, different modes of being. That's bhava tanha. And then vibhava tanha, the craving to not be, the craving to annihilate oneself. That's leading into upadana. So this is a very interesting link between tanha and upadana. So craving acts as a conditioning factor, and conditions allows clinging to arise. So this clinging is very important. The Kruba Ajahnsa teach it like it's not just that craving is giving rise to clinging, but it's that there's a clinging to the craving. So that craving can arise, but then there's another step. There's a clinging to the craving. So this now makes perfect sense. Why would Ajahn Mun say there is greed, there is fear, there is all these things because I have a heart? Why does he say that? You say, oh, but, you know, it says in the suttas, arhants don't have any greed, they don't have any craving. But there's this clinging. He's completely free of clinging. So it's this clinging to the craving. And when Longpo Sumedho was visiting here recently, he was hammering that point over and over and over again. I think I've picked it up in almost every talk or discussion that I heard. Was like, it's not craving, it's the clinging to the craving. So this is a very important point that Longpo Sumedho has picked up on. So once there's this clinging giving rise to bhava, which is like it's like taking birth, or it's like going into an existence. Bhava is like, it's translated as existence, so it's like coming into a form of existence. And then jati is birth, being born into a certain type of experience. Or you can also think of it in the lifetime way, like actual physical birth, it means that as well. And then the final step being aging, sickness, and death, and dukkha, which is translated as sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair at its coarsest level. So all kinds of dukkha, all kinds of imbalance, disease, dissonance. Then it continues on. After dukkha, then there is two results. There's two results when dukkha arises. There's two ways we react, and we search. We search for a way out of dukkha. There's two kinds of search. There's the search that leads to more dukkha, and there's the search that leads to the ending of dukkha. So most of us continue searching to get out of dukkha, but we're doing things that are perpetuating the cycle of dukkha, because there's avijja, there's not knowing, not seeing. We don't really know what's going to put an end to dukkha, so we keep searching, keep trying different things, and it keeps perpetuating the cycle. So everybody wants to be out of dukkha, nobody wants to suffer, and everybody keeps doing things which are bringing about the very thing we don't want. And so that's the search that leads to more dukkha. And then there's also a search which leads to the ending of dukkha, which is what the Buddha realized under the Bodhi tree in his own search, in his own practice, his own cultivation. And of course, that's the Noble Eightfold Path. That's what we have handed down to us, 56? Oh, it must be 57. No, it's 58 after the end of Pansa. Anyway, 2,557 or so, plus or minus a year, years ago, we have handed down to us, we are the heirs to that, the teaching of the Noble Eightfold Path, the unmistaken way to the ending of suffering if one follows it. And it behooves us to follow it. The Buddha gave this analogy of the spears. So if one was to somehow be captured by enemies and pierced by 100 spears in the morning, 100 spears in the afternoon, and 100 spears in the evening, somehow missed all the vital organs, didn't die, and somehow healed. And every single day for 100 years, one had a very long life, and one was pierced by all those spears every day for 100 years. And if by that happening, if because of being pierced by all those spears every day for so long and undergoing so much torment and agony, one was to realize the Four Noble Truths, then I say that you should choose to undergo that much agony because it would be worth it. It would be worth it to realize the Four Noble Truths based on that agony. But that kind of suffering is not necessary for realizing the Four Noble Truths. So how much more so to follow this path? So it's right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. And these have various definitions and meanings. People can look it up or keep listening to Dhamma talks and you'll learn a lot more. But it's making oneself right so that we have right and proper liberation from the cycle of samsara. And so it's quite fortunate that we're also part of the forest tradition, because it's the practice of Dhamma where, you know, when you live it, when you practice it, it's very, very real. It's when it's, you realize it's birth and death. It's not in the book. It's something that's happening to us. And kama is something that's happening to us. And we will die. All of us will die. All of us will die. No doubt at all. And we don't know when. And so this is real. This is not something that we need to take notes about. It's something that can be known directly. So the Dhamma is apparent here and now. And we have to do what we can to balance ourselves and to practice and to ask ourselves, how well am I spending my time? How can I adjust myself? How can I make it right? Is there any part of the Noble Eightfold Path that isn't right? And if so, make it right. Instead of bemoaning that it isn't right, just go ahead and make it right. Just do it. So you have to have that vision of rightness, walk within that vision of rightness. And that Noble Eightfold Path, the teachings are there. I was very inspired in Thailand listening to a talk of Lungpa Liam, and he used this phrase, Satta Samukhi Puto, which means the teacher is present, the teacher is here. So even though the Buddha passed in Nibbana a long time ago, the teachings are here. It's as if the Buddha is present. It's as if the teacher is present. You know, not too long ago, we have great teachers, Master Xuan Hua, Lungpa Cha. Also, as listening to this talk in Thailand, I couldn't understand all the Thai, but this Ajahn, his name is Ajahn Sumedhi. He lives at a very, very remote branch monastery of Wat Pa Phong, and he's the abbot there. And he's known for giving really, really good Dhamma talks. So he comes out of his monastery and gives talks on these like Katina, all-night Katina talks. He'll usually be one of the speakers. People always look forward to his talks. And he lives in a very remote village, so a lot of the lay people in the village where he lives, where he has his monastery, they don't really know about Wat Pa Phong or Ajahn Chah except through him. He would talk about Ajahn Chah a lot and quote Ajahn Chah, and he never really mentioned that Ajahn Chah had passed away 20 or so years ago, and the lay people thought Ajahn Chah was still alive. And so then someone came to him and was asking, like, you know, how old is Ajahn Chah now? How is he doing? And he said, well, he's actually not alive anymore. And the layperson is like, oh, wow, you know, you always talk about him as if he's alive. And then, so Ajahn Sumedhi's giving this talk at Wat Pa Phong, and he's reflecting, he's telling this story about how the lay people thought Ajahn Chah was still alive. And then he said, and then I realized, actually, Ajahn Chah is still alive. And then he started crying during his Dhamma talk. It was quite lovely. So Satta Samukhi Buddho, the teacher is present. And I think that's a good place to leave it this evening. Namaste.
Amen.